Good evening. Greetings in Jesus' name. I think I need a little boldness. The subject is one that is dear to my heart. I enjoy history. I always have. But I confess to be a little wavering and quivering. Roots of 16th century Anabaptism is our theme. And we think of Anabaptism, we think of 16th century, we think of the 1500s. And if you think of roots, okay, the thought is obviously then what's underneath it, or where did the 16th century come from, or what was the foundation of the 16th century? And so that is, in a nutshell, what the lesson this evening is on. I guess you could call it a lesson. Now, I have a thought I want to start out with. It was interesting, as I would talk to people, since this came out, some people would say, "Oh, why do you? I mean, talk about history." And I know history gets a bad rap, and I'm not sure why. Well, I have my own reasons for that, for thinking or for conceptualizing why history gets a bad rap. I don't know what they all are. That's not the purpose this evening. But history can be difficult. I think in a lot of ways it depends how it's portrayed. It can be a dry study filled with facts and numbers and years and people who are very, very old. But history is something, I believe. This point, I want to begin with this, and I want to probably, Lord willing, close with this thought, but history is an anchor to the soul. Because where you are today in relation to where you have been is the history. What is behind you is your anchor. And where you are today, you could say it like this: this is my history, this is where I am. That all is an anchor, and it's a guidepost, it's a directional indicator of where you will be, to some extent. Now, God does bring things into our lives. And man does make choices. But I think it's helpful to think of history sometimes as a link. There's a past link, there's a present link, and there's a future link. Now, some of you that have, well, wait, one more statement yet. Two more statements. For those of you who have a dim view of history, this is for you. Can a people who do not have an understanding or appreciation for where they come from have a clear vision of where they want to go? Maybe that's a bit of an overstatement. But if you don't have the foggiest clue and the desire to understand, I really question, I think you're going to have more difficulties than what you could in the future. I really do believe that. And it goes back again to that picture of a chain with three links, because it's sort of like the foundation of where you will be. Another thought I want to, introducing thought here, is I want to hold up Jesus Christ and not these instruments of clay that we're going to be discussing. These are men. None of them were perfect men. They all made mistakes. And we want to glorify Jesus Christ. He deserves the credit for these men's lives. He deserves the credit for each one of us and what we are. Now, some of you that have heard me talk about Anabaptist history before know how I'm going to start this out. I'm going to start out with some names. Because another thing, sometimes people can't make a connection with history. And so that makes it all the more difficult to appreciate it if you can't make a connection. So I'm going to connect you. Okay? Now you listen. Now I'm going to read off some surnames, last names, of Anabaptists who lived in the 1300s to the 1700s. And yet, let's see if you can make a connection. Oberholzer, Weaver, Gingrich, Kaufman, Haldeman, Burkholder, Landis, Neuenschwander, Lehman, Whitmer, Schenck, Zeisset, Musselman, Hershey, Groff, Hirsch, Good, Baumann, Zimmerman, Martin, Ebersole, Nolte, Eby. I just stopped there because I could go on. And I did bring the names up to date. Some of those names were, the spellings of those were somewhat recognizable, others more difficult. Some of them did not change at all. Neuenschwander did not change. Some of these are, as they showed up, hundreds of years ago. Now, if you're here this evening and you didn't hear your name mentioned, I guarantee you, though, you have a friend with that name, with one of these names, and I only gave you a partial list. I could have gone on and on. Okay, so that's the connection. Now, Swigert is not on there. You have to go back five generations from me, and that's where it meets the Mennonites. And there's others of you. I see some of you here. I know some of you do not have names that I have in the list here. And that doesn't matter so much. It doesn't matter much at all. Except for history 400 years from now. That may depend on what you do with it. Point number one. In understanding roots of 16th century Anabaptism, point number one is there is an unbroken line of faithfulness from the time of Acts to 1525. The faithful church did not start in 1525. And I'd like to draw a timeline showing some of this, or showing what I'm talking about. Let's start with the time of Christ. Of course, that was 33. And let's move forward. We have the period after the time of Christ of Acts. The book of Acts takes place in that time, of course. Let's jump forward, from 33 to about, let's call this the 300 mark. How many think there were faithful churches in that time? Well, of course we do. We all know that. There were faithful churches. There was faithful individuals. One of the great pivot points in church history happened about 300. And that was, let me back up here a little bit. During this time, the world, the then known world, Western world, was ruled by Rome. Rome was a strong empire, and Rome persecuted the church, and that started in the book of Acts with Stephen, with Apostle Paul was beheaded. You read the Martyr's Mirror, all of the apostles lost their lives with the exception of John. So Rome persecuted the Christians very, very heavily. Persecution was full tilt during this period. The reign of Diocletian, it was especially bad. Now, And so let's, up until about 300, and then there was a Roman emperor with the name of Constantine. And we're going to be talking about him quite a bit in some of these evenings. We're just going to let it go right now, but that is a pivotal place in church history. We move forward to the 400s. The major event that we have happening in 400, I think it was 476, was the fall of Rome. And the fall of the Roman Empire. And with that period, with that happening, there is a period of history that begins there that's called the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages. But the first period of it is called the Dark Ages. And the Dark Ages last from, I need to check my notes here again. Yes, from the fall of Rome up until about 1000 AD. I know this timeline's getting a little, it's not quite correct here, but 1000 AD is the period of the Dark Ages. And the period of the Middle Ages then goes all the way up till 1500s. Let's call it 1500. Of course, the Reformation starts in 1517 with Martin Luther and so on, which brings us up to the period of the Anabaptists, 1525. All right, now, so this period is called the Middle Ages, from 400 to 1500. And this, so the question is that I have for you, and sometimes when we study Anabaptist history, we read Bible history, and then we jump up to 1525 and say, oh, by the way, all of a sudden there appears on the scene the Anabaptists. And we wonder, okay, well, what happened? There's 1,000 years in here. No, there's 1,500 years, 1,400 years. Were there Christians then? Were there faithful Christians? And I want to answer yes. And that's the whole point of this evening's topic. You could ask the question, and I'm not sure if I can answer this question as to why that is, other than one of the great inventions that happened in the world was the printing press, and that would have happened right at this point. And so that does explain maybe why suddenly there was history being able to be recorded, and why it seems like there's an explosion of books, and there's an explosion of histories that we have a lot of information that we have that we did not have earlier. So we want to discuss this evening the church period from here to here. And we can only go through this very briefly. I cannot spend a lot of time at this. Okay, so we have established the fact that there is an unbroken line of faithfulness. And I want to next move into this question, where there is a faithful church, there is also a dying church or decaying church. And so we have this, again, we have this faithful church, but we also have a dying church or decaying church. And what is a dying church? Well, number one, a church that loses its identity, because scriptural obedience is disregarded, and as a result, it becomes no different than society. And a dying church, okay, it loses its identity. The Bible loses its importance. People don't read it. Church leaders don't preach it. And the church loses its separation. It loses its distinctiveness. And it blends into society. So that was happening during the Dark Ages, obviously. You had the Roman Church, the Roman Catholic Church, begin to, when Rome fell, there was another empire that took its place. It was called the Roman Catholic Church, and it was became very, very strong during that period. Extremely strong. You probably remember this in history, but just to bring it up again, there was a French king, I believe, that wanted to get permission from the Pope, and the Pope made him stand outside barefooted for several days or something like that, just to give you an idea of the extreme power that the Pope had during this time. More about him later. But number two, a dying church gets involved with the political affairs of government. And that happened during the time of Constantine, the church and state mixed. More on that later. Number three, a church that institutes and revolves its theology around dead traditions and rites. And this, again, something that happened during this, during the Dark Ages here, the church was dying. There was these things that came into the Roman Catholic Church. There was the Mass, M-A-S-S. Mass is the Roman Catholic worship service. More can be said about it. I think we'll let that go. Purgatory, the concept of a place where you go after a person dies, they go to purgatory and they burn in hell till their badness is burned out, and then they can go into heaven. False doctrine. Transubstantiation, the process whereby in Mass, during Mass, a priest gives you the bread and the wine in it, and it turns into Jesus' body and blood there. The concept or the thing of veneration was something that was instituted by the political and by the church authorities. Veneration to the priest. And veneration was this thing of gazing longingly or with wide attention or rapt attention to holy things. There was a spirit that was being lost here. It was being replaced by these dead traditions and rites. The worship of Mary and other saints, the worship of relics. There was supposedly some Jesus sweat that was saved. That Jesus sweated great drops of blood, as it said, in Gethsemane. Well, that was saved and worshiped. The actual cross and images and so on. Again, this is a dying church that revolves its theology around these kinds of things. Number four, a church that substitutes God-ordained church authority structures for man-made structures. A church that substitutes God-ordained church authority structures for man-made structures. And this is where the papacy, where I want to bring this in, the papacy became, the church structure, whole structure became very abusive, very, very powerful. Very powerful. Checks and balances were not respected. There was no, even emperors and kings could not control the power of the church here. It was grown way out of its bounds, and for some reasons that we'll get into more later. Okay, now, what I'd like to do now is talk about some of the faithful groups. Now, I just got done talking about the dying church that was from... Well, I said wherever there's a faithful church, there's a dying church. Okay, so we talked about the dying church and during some of these periods, it was especially strong. And I said that there was faithfulness throughout this period. And we want to talk about that now. And when you think of faithful churches, you probably think of the Waldensians. And we're not going to talk about them much tonight, but that was a church group that possibly, I didn't even really study this much, but I think it would have been about the 1 to 200s, maybe 1200, I think is the period where they might have started. The Petrobusians, the Lollards, there's many more could be mentioned, and I'm not going to mention the groups so much. Now, what I would like to do is use this book as kind of a springboard, and I highly recommend the book. It's The Reformers and Their Stepchildren. And some of this information that's in this book was in Cup and Cross. How many are familiar with Cup and Cross? Okay, quite a number of you, I believe, had that at school. So some of this might be a little bit familiar to you, but I think he gets a lot of his information from this book. And we want to start out with the Donatists. And they stem all the way back to the 300s. The Donatists were a faithful group. Now, I'm not saying, and some of this, especially with the Donatists, it should be mentioned that not there. If you dig into history very thoroughly, you will find some things that were not even correct about the Donatists. But what is so fascinating to me is what I want to show you next here on the board. And I'm going to make another diagram here. And I'm going to reflect the period as it was up till 300. Again, Christ, 33 AD, period of Christ, 300 AD. Now, we're going to make the top line, what I actually meant there is the state. I'm going to make another line. Called the church. Because if you go to this period, you remember there was catacombs, right? What was the point of the catacombs? The catacombs was a hiding place for the Christians. There was conflict here between the state and the church. Much conflict. The Christians, the faithful Christians, had to hide. Their churches were in secret. They had their services in secret. They needed to hide. I mentioned Diocletian. There was Hadrian was a persecutor. There was many of the Roman emperors from the period of Christ up until 300 were fierce persecutors. Some not as much as Diocletian. But there was the constant friction. The church and state were separate, but the state fought the church. I don't know how else to put it. But something happened in 300, and we could go into the reasons why that happened, but Constantine united the church and state into one. Constantine was a Roman emperor who came to power in a legitimate way. He was a very strong ruler. He was, be that as it may. But what happened when the church and state became united? What had to have happened in order for there to be a true church? Could the church and state stay united? What happened automatically was this. The true church separated. This continued. Leonard Verdun, the writer of the book there, calls it the hybrid. Now, you young men who like to study cars, you know all about hybrids, right? A hybrid is a half electric and a half gas or fossil fuel powered car, correct? That's a hybrid because the two are mixed. Well, this was the hybrid church. And this was the true church. And nominal Christian historians look back to this period with a lot of excitement and enthusiasm. And it was a wonderful thing to finally have the church be able to blossom and to grow and for persecution to cease. But persecution did not cease. The same tension that you had between this church and state here were duplicated here. The true church and the hybrid church did not get along. Now, the true church here were the Donatists. As soon as the church and state were united by Constantine, we have record of the Donatists coming out. And they, of course, obviously stood for the concept of the uniting of the church and state being a false one, and that comes out very strong. They also held very strongly to a voluntary church. And what I failed to mention here, and I should mention this now, is Constantine was enabled and helped by a church theologian with the name of Augustine. And actually, he was a little after Constantine, but he was a Augustine built upon what Constantine had started and gave not biblical basis. He gave church authority, or gave the nominal hybrid church justification for doing what it did. And Augustine used Luke 14, verse 23. And this is interesting. Remember, I said the Donatists were held to a voluntary church life. And we take this, dear youth here tonight, we take this so for granted that we can hardly get in our minds what this, a church life that is involuntary. And we're going to, I think it's tomorrow evening, we're going to talk about this in greater detail. But Luke 14 is the account where Jesus gives the parable of the Great Supper, and he tells his servants to bring come, for all things are ready. And they began to make excuse. I'm kind of running through this for the sake of time. They gave excuses for this. This person gave this excuse. This person gave that excuse. But the master said, go out and bring in the poor and the maimed and the halt. And the servant said, Lord, it's done, and yet there's room. And the Lord said unto his servant, go out in the highways and hedges and compel them to come in. In other words, use force. That's what Augustine said this meant. Looking at this verse, Augustine said, okay, well, this is what the church does now. Instead of a voluntary church, the church, the hybrid church, goes out and forces people to become a Christian. So you can see this mixing of church and state really did nothing at all. It was a false church. It was a hybrid church. And understanding that principle, I believe, helps us to understand what the Anabaptists were up against. Now, the next couple terms I'm going to give you are terms that were given the Anabaptists by the state church, by the hybrid church. And I'm going to be using, from this point on, I'm going to be using the word heretics, because the state church, the hybrid church, called the true church, the Donatists and others, they called them heretics. A heretic is a dissenter from an established church dogma, especially a baptized member of the Roman Catholic Church who disavows a revealed truth. And so the true Christians were heretics. Now, I don't mean that they believed in heresy, but from the standpoint of the hybrid church, they were heretics because they did not believe what the church wanted them to believe. They believed this, but they did not believe what the hybrid church wanted them to believe. So that was the Donatists. But now some of the... Okay, now the number two is called the Stabler. S-T-A-B-L-E-R. Stabler. And this was these terms I'm going to be using now. There's the next seven ones, I think it's seven, are, and we should have Brother Harry's not here tonight. These are Swiss German terms, and I don't know. I probably won't pronounce them right, but Staubler might be correct. But these were sort of nicknames or derogatory names that the hybrid church gave to the Anabaptists, gave to the true church, gave to the Donatists, or to the separatists. I hardly know what to call them because they were. This is before the time when we usually think of Anabaptists. They weren't really called that then. But these were some of the derogatory names. They were just brethren. They were just the true church. But they were called Stauber. Now, why were they called Stauber? Well, because they carried a staff. And this was a mark of separation between the general people who, the hybrid church people who carried a sword. Back in those days, a man carried a sword. It was his part of his dress, I guess. But it was a sure sign of a heretic to see a staff carrier instead of a sword carrier. And history bears this out. It's very, very interesting that back during this period, I'm going way back in history now, way back before the Anabaptists, before Felix Mons, George Blaurock. This is hundreds of years before this. The staff carriers were, of course, non-resistant. They did not carry a sword because the sword was a part of the state. They carried a wooden staff instead. I don't know if I guess won't take time to read that. But Calvin had some things to say about that. John Calvin did. But that was the Stauber. There was a second group that were called the Cathars. I guess I won't write that one down. The Cathar, Cathar, and those believed in the concept of a holy church. Okay, going back to Augustine again. One of the things that Augustine, you can say it either way. So Augustine, in his going out to the highways and hedges and compelling them to come in, they compelled everyone to come in, and the concept of a holy church was lost. The church was not a group like we have it here together of separated holy people. It was everyone. It was a composite of society. It was a reflection of society because the whole society was there. The whole society was forced to be there. And the Cathars were ones who resisted that and said that can't be right. According to God's word, they were Bible readers, what they had. And they would have had the Old and New Testament, of course. But they said the church must be a holy church. It must be called out people. It must be separated people. You also have the Winklers. W-I-N-C-K-L-E-R, the Winklers. And this was a name, again, these are sort of slangish, derogatory names that were given to the true worshipers while they were being persecuted, while they were being hunted down, while they were being laughed at and scorned. They were called Winklers. Why were they called Winklers? Well, I don't think they winked a lot. It was because they gathered in secret. And this started all the way back in the catacombs, but they did not gather in the big open churches. Well, they couldn't. They were persecuted. They had to find a separate place to worship. And so they worshipped in the harness shops. They worshipped in the weaver's shops. They worshipped out in the mountains. They worshipped here and there, places in quiet. They were called Winklers. And you also have the Weidertaufer. W-E-I-D-E-R-T-A-U-F-E-R, Weidertaufer. It simply means rebaptizer, and we'll be saying more about that other evenings, but that was a name given to the, they were rebaptized. These strange people, they didn't accept the fact that being baptized as a baby was enough. What was the matter with them? They're rebaptizers. They're strange people. You also have the sacrament swarmers. Sacrament swarmer, S-C-H-W-A-M-E-R. And these are people who did not believe that salvation is received by partaking of the sacraments, or ordinances, I should say. They believed back in this time that as this priest was making his rounds in Mass, that all a person had to do was open his mouth and the priest would put the bread on his tongue and the believer, the person didn't have to do anything. And that purified him. And that concept is totally lost. At least I guess it is. I hope it is. I'm not sure. This one might affect us more than what we realize sometimes. This concept of, well, I'll get myself ready for communion, but the rest of the 6 months I can kind of live as I want, I think is a step in this direction where there's some kind of special life that comes because we partake of communion. No, dear youth, that is not the case at all. It's only a reflection. It's only an ordinance of what we do to prove that there is a true experience. And the next one is the loafer, L-E-U-F-E-R. It's one who walks or runs. In other words, a missionary. And if you think about this fact, that back to Augustine again, this going out in the highways and hedges and compelling them to come in, you're going to bring a whole hodgepodge of people in, and you just push them into the, you just force them in. And that's all that needs done. Why do you go out and witness? Because you baptize them as if you forcibly baptize them as an infant, thereby guaranteeing their salvation. And why do you have to witness? Why the whole, excuse me, so the whole missionary concept was lost on the, it was lost during this period. And it was the true Christians who were the loafers who were walking around. This is why, for example, if you remember the pictures in your history books of Christopher Columbus discovering America, you have a picture of him standing there, and maybe the caption would read, or what was in his mind was, "For God and Spain." It was a whole concept of claiming the new territory, not just for Spain, but for God, for the hybrid church, for the false church, for the Roman Catholic Church. But it was a false concept, and these again were separated people, the loafers who were known as those who walk and run, go out two by two, direct obedience to the Gospels. It's wonderful. And you have the Rottengeisters, and if that sounds like a really negative term, it is. It's Rottengeister means faction maker or a clique organizer. That's interesting to me. They didn't fit with the program. They were just sore spots. They didn't fit. They were a people within a people, or a church within a church. Praise the Lord, they were. And by now you should be drawing some parallels. Why are we a separated people? Because we're supposed to be. If we start fitting in, youth, we're not heretics. Do we have heretics here tonight? Now, I don't mean fitting in with Youth Institute. I don't mean fitting in with Bible school. I don't mean fitting in with your congregations. That's not what I'm talking about. But dear youth tonight, if there's not a conflict between you and out there, then something's wrong. Rottengeisters just didn't fit in. Well, we need to bring this, we need to conclude this. Lessons to learn. Number one, Anabaptism, loosely defined, existed from the birth of the true church all the way through history to us today. And that's a comforting thought when we think of how important history is and how I opened with that thought of how it helps us to understand more clearly who we are and why we're here if we realize that there's a whole history behind us. The Mennonite church didn't start in 15. The Mennonite church didn't start in 1525. The Mennonite church today stands for some of the things I just mentioned, holy church life and obedience to the scriptures. It's encouraging for me to realize that as long, even through the dark ages, there was people like you. There was youth who were faithful. There was fathers who were faithful. There were church leaders that were faithful. Number two, because we believe this, it helps us to realize that the things we face today, the things that youth face today, were faced by youth, by God's people, over and over throughout time, and will continue to be a challenge for God's people as long as there is time. Will the unbroken line continue? Will your surname be included because you were faithful? Are we a faithful church or a dying church? Are you a heretic this evening? For closing thoughts, you can turn to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, excuse me, verse 13. This is the account of the faithful, the faith chapter. And this verse 13, these all died in faith, is of course referencing Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Abel, excuse me, and so on. But I'd like to relate it to the Cathars, to the Winklers, to the Weidertoffers, to the Lufers, the Rottengeisters, the Stauber, the Donatists. These all died in faith, not having received the promises. Well, in a sense, they did have the New Testament. But having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Verse 14, for they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is a heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. And I believe that's where these folks are today. I believe they're in that better country. They're in that better city, and they're rejoicing, they're in peace, they're in with the presence of Jesus Christ. And may our testimony, if God should preserve the church for another 100 years, another 500 years, would there be a group of youth that are still unbroken, the line is still unbroken, and their names have names that are reflected here tonight. May God bless.